Hi there. Welcome to the latest episode of our Artemis Live podcast. This week, we're continuing to share insights from expert panelists who helped us at our recent virtual ILS Asia conference. They shared a significant amount of their expertise and insights with the audience there, so we wanted to make that available to our podcast subscribers as well. So this latest episode features a panel discussion on the role of insurance-linked securities in narrowing protection gaps in Asia. The panel features Simon Goh, partner at Rajah & Tann Singapore, Ilian Chin, Deputy Director at the Monetary Authority of Singapore, Michael Bennett, the Head of Derivatives and Structured Finance at the World Bank Treasury, and Corey Anger, Managing Director at GC Securities. The panelists discussed the way the Asia-Pacific region has become a key component of the global insurance-linked securities marketplace, not least as a diversifying peril, but also as with ILS as a key piece of cedent's risk transfer programs. And they all said that cedent and issuer interest continues to surge in the region, and investor interest is also growing. The Asia-Pacific region is seen as very important for investors and very valuable to the investors in the ILS space, as it's seen as this key diversifier from US risk, which is the most prevalent. And so growth is expected. Assisting with this growth is obviously the emergence of Singapore as an ILS hub, and with now a number of catastrophe bonds under its belt and more expected to come, that's expected to drive not just transaction flow in the region, but actual issuance from sponsors in the region and issuance of cat bonds structured with Asia Pacific perils. The ILS grant scheme in Singapore has now been extended. That's expected to drive significant interest over the coming years, and should see the region growing its share of the ILS market as a whole. In addition, we now have obviously Hong Kong, which is also on the road to becoming a ILS domicile as well, and has a perhaps unique position in terms of being able to connect risk and capital for the Chinese market in a way nobody else perhaps can. There's also interest from potential public sector sponsors as well. And the World Bank's Michael Bennett said that interest was high among the investor community for the Asian deals that he's been involved in. And the recent Philippine cat bond, which included Singapore for the first time on the roadshow list, was one of the most attended of the series of roadshows that he held that time around, as potential investors sought to educate themselves on ILS. And we expect much more of this to come. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with some really interesting and experienced people. Please do stay tuned to Artemis at www.artemis.bm for all of our ILS and reinsurance capital news and analysis. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to ILS Asia 2020. This is our first live panel of the sessions, and we're talking about today the role of ILS in closing Asia's risk financing gaps. So I'm delighted to have some experienced speakers from around the world. We're dealing with multiple time zones here today. We have Simon Goh, partner and head of the insurance and reinsurance practice at Rajah & Tann Singapore LLP. We have Ilian Chin. She is Deputy Director and Head of the Insurance Funds and Infrastructure Finance Division in the Monetary Authority of Singapore. We have Michael Bennett, the Head of Derivatives and Structured Finance at the World Bank Treasury. And we have Corey Anger, Managing Director at GC Securities. So a brief bit of housekeeping, just so you all know, we have a Q&A application which you can use to submit questions during the session. We will get to those at the end of the session today. And you can also maximize the window for the video screen if you want to see us in all our glory, or you can minimize us if you'd rather just listen. That's really down to you. So to sort of summarize, we're going to be talking about the role of ILS in closing Asia's risk financing gaps today. Obviously, catastrophe bonds have played a role in securing disaster risk financing capacity for insurers, reinsurers, corporates, and governments or sovereign entities all around the world. And in Asia, we've seen cat bonds since the late 90s. But as the ILS market continues to mature and grow, we've got an expanding range of solutions available to participants now. new options emerging for issuance in the way of structures and domicile locations, meaning that for Asia, there's likely to be an increased use of the capital markets backed sources of capacity. And as we heard this morning in a keynote speech, PMLs, the amount, the value at risk in Asia is increasing significantly. So as a result, right now, as the values at risk are expanding more quickly than insurance penetration, the gap is actually widening, and perhaps the role, therefore, all the more important for the ILS market to participate there. So I thought to begin, we would talk about what has gone well so far in terms of the ILS market's work in Asia. And I'll just invite perhaps Corey to begin.
Sure. So Asia is a key part of the ILS market, in different forms, whether it be through the representative exposure that comes through and quota shares that investors assume through sidecar participation, and then more overtly through either collateralized reinsurance or cap on activity. So the Asia-Pac region is important for investors. It is actually valued by investors because it's seen as a diversifier from the U.S. risk, which is the most prevalent risk to date. But obviously, as the Asia-Pac region continues to grow, we look forward to the day when the Asia-Pac region is starting to rival from an exposure perspective what the U.S. has already been bringing to the market, both from a penetration perspective and then just the economic growth engine that's happening. I would say that we see most of our activity out of Japan, but we've been very encouraged by various actions that are happening, whether it's been select transactions out of China, Philippines, Australia, Taiwan, we've seen historically. We're very excited by these transactions and would love to get more representation from these regions on a more consistent basis.
Absolutely. Michael, from your perspective, working with governments and sovereigns around the world, how have you, obviously your first transaction in Asia is fairly recent with the Philippines cap bond, but obviously you've been engaging with governments in the region for a long time. Can you give us some perspective on sort of what the ILS market has done well so far?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you, Steve, for having me. I really wish this could be in Singapore. It doesn't feel right to be in a Singapore conference with no access to duck noodle or chicken rice, but hopefully next year we'll be there. From our perspective, what's gone well is a lot of interest. We've seen in the last year, and even more so since the Philippine transaction, occurred a lot of interest from clients in the area. The kinds of transactions we do, the difference between or the time lag between interest and transaction can be measured in, usually is measured in years and not months. But we've definitely seen an uptick in interest from potential public sector sponsors. We've also seen a lot of interest from investors. We had for the Philippines transaction a roadshow that went to New York, London, Zurich, and Singapore. I think it was the first time a cat bonded roadshow in Singapore. And Singapore was actually our largest roadshow stop in terms of attendees. And it was also, I'm pretty sure, the stop where we had the most active Q&A. Now, admittedly, only a few of those investors ended up in the book because a lot of them were there to learn about cat bonds. But I think it was indicative of increasing interest in the region for cat bonds.
Thank you, Michael. Yes, and that's very positive to hear that the right questions are getting asked. It's the only way the market gets educated. Simon, Ilian, anything to add on sort of what you've seen since Singapore's been active in the market, perhaps, and how the ILS market has engaged with you guys in the region?
Maybe I'll go first and I'll let Eileen sweep up from her perspective. But definitely, I think things have taken a huge uptick since the first cat bond that we worked with is Corey, the IAG. And a lot has changed, I think, over the past 18 months or so. So, of course, I think the focus for us, as Eileen will probably elaborate, is really to see whether we can get more interest from the Asian space, the Asian risk bearers, Asian investors. And we've also seen since the first two 144A deals we did, interest from particularly the Japanese market. So that has also resulted in the first Asian sponsored cat bond earlier this year. So I think definitely interest has taken a significant turn for the better over the past 2 years or so. Eileen?
Hi, Simon. I think Singapore so far has been the location of choice for 9 ILS deals to date, since the first one issued by IAG Re in December 2019. So we have come, you know, a long way. You know, 9 deals in 1 year, it says a lot about the viability of Singapore as ILS domicile. And this includes, you know, 2 deals from the Asian region, including the first sovereign bond covering the Philippines earthquake and typhoon risk issued under the World Bank Capital at Risk platform, as well as Japanese typhoon and flood risk issued by MSAD. So based on our interactions with cedents and issuers from around the world, I think we can safely say that we continue to see a strong pipeline of Asian cedents wanting to tap on Singapore as an ILS domicile in the next 12 to 18 months, including insurers in Japan, Australia, China, Hong Kong, and Korea. And we certainly hope to foster the same level of interest from insurers in Southeast Asia as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, with obviously Asian risks are seen as an attractive diversifying peril for ILS funds still. It's still a smaller component of the market, but as I said earlier, the PMLs are rising rapidly and the potential is there for it to grow significantly. So, I mean, Corey, from your experience, obviously you've been looking after transactions in this marketplace for a long time now, and you've seen Asia sort of moving along, largely focused on Japan. Would you hope to see the kind of expansion that Ilian just referred to, with sponsors coming from a much broader section of countries?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think, as Michael noted, at least he sees on a sovereign level that it can take years for these to develop, whether it's voluntary companies or private companies, or even public sector that aren't necessarily at the sovereign level. It can take a while for these concepts to come to the forefront where they actively want to pursue a transaction. Many times the biggest barrier is just pricing. So if you're not looking to change how you're buying and you're not looking for incremental limit, then it's really a competitive aspect between what the ILS market can provide in single limit capacity versus what the traditional reinsurance market can provide in, you know, single limit plus reinstatement. And then it becomes more of an economic comparison. I think what's going to be exciting is, one, we having this established jurisdiction in Singapore, and I know that Hong Kong is also moving to expand and offer another alternative within the Asia-Pac region. And so I think both of those are very exciting. I think all of that helps encourage cedents, again, whether we're talking about insurers, reinsurers, or corporate entities, to start thinking about using this protection. But generally, we see clients reach out to this market when we're going through periods of turbulence. And that turbulence can be caused from significant losses. And obviously, we've seen significant typhoon losses in Japan. So it's natural that people are rethinking how they're buying. We also see the same thing in Australia with the wildfires and some of the severe hailstorms. And I think that creates opportunity. But then overhanging all of this is the COVID-19 effect to the markets overall, whether it's going to come from actual losses in the treaties from you know, paying out COVID-related claims, or the impact to the market from a capacity and a pricing perspective because of the exposures that are happening globally from COVID-19. And so with all of that uncertainty in the mix, it usually creates a lot more interest in discussions around alternative capital And I think now that we've gotten through the July 1st renewals of this year, we've had a very heavy pipeline. Everything will start to pivot toward, probably give it till mid-August, mid to late August before people really turn in earnest, but it is going to start to pivot toward the January 1st renewals.
Absolutely, and that should be quite interesting given most people are predicting the firming to continue, and obviously cat bonds in a firming environment can sometimes seem an even more sort of complementary source of coverage at sometimes commensurate pricing or better pricing even. The sort of the efficiency of the capital markets can be recognized more sometimes in a firming environment, it seems.
That's correct. It just makes it easier when you're talking about something on a pricing basis that's more consistent with each other, and then you can get down to the different structures and terms. The way that this has worked for other clients in other jurisdictions is that when the traditional market isn't willing to provide a certain type of cover that the ILS market is, that's also a catalyst. So I think, again, there's going to be lots of opportunities. I think while it's hard to cover the ongoing COVID-19 potential exposures, there was already dialogue around pandemic risk before coming into this event, but I think there's going to be a lot more coming out because I think there's likely to be some regulatory changes and more explicitly recognizing capital charges around it. So, you know, COVID may be a contributor, but also could be a catalyst. But, you know, this market is open and available. I think one of the things that's very interesting is to look at the performance of the ILS market in general through COVID and the availability of capital. It could have been very easy for this market to have stepped back, shrunk, and/or paused how it's been taking on risk. But in fact, we've done, and if I just take the cap on segment, excluding collateralized re and sidecars, just in the cap on segment, we've already placed in the first half of this year more risk than we placed in 2019, and you know we've had I think 17 sponsors access the market since really COVID reared its head. So I think what's interesting is that it shows that the capital is very committed, and the performance of this space is actually aligned where it's played out again, like we saw through the financial crisis and other broader capital markets events. That this asset class can be very stable when people do have liquidity in the market to be able to generate cash for either redeployment in this space or for other reasons, investor redemptions or margin calls or rotate to other sectors. The fact that this market had a very active secondary market and has continued to provide the capacity, I think, is quite remarkable.
Mm. Yes, I'd agree. It really has been. I think the performance of the market has been something that will help to bring additional investors to the space. Certainly, it's going to attract people. Michael, your recent transaction in the Philippines, which is one example of a brand new sovereign sponsor, that cap bond was a number of years in the making. It's quite a long process, obviously, these things. Can you talk us through some of the challenges faced and how you overcame them?
Yeah, well, I think any public sector deal, and probably more so even at the sovereign level, you need a lot of buy-in from different parts of the government. You sometimes need legislative changes. Sometimes those exactly what legislative changes you need aren't well understood until you're already in the process, and then you may have you realize you need legislation, so then you have a 6-month break while you try to get the legislation passed so you can move forward. And anytime you're talking about a long time lag with a government, then you can also face the issue of elections, and governments can change. Certainly officials can change. Officials can change seats. So all of these things can and do occur on our transactions. Of course, the Philippines always had a plan to do a cat bond over a number of years, but it wasn't as if that was all they were doing. So they were doing other insurance transactions in the meantime, including some with the World Bank. So it wasn't as if they were just doing nothing but working on a cat bond for multiple years. It was just that that became sort of the last step in the layer of transactions they were putting on at that time. That's I think why the World Bank is important. The World Bank I think some of our other peer institutions in the development world are looking at this area as well now. I think it's why we're important because it's difficult, I think, for private sector players to invest that kind of time on a transaction. I mean, some firms are really good. Certainly Corey's firm is. Corey works with us sometimes for years before she ever gets paid. But in general, the private sector, I think, would have a difficult time working very intensively on a transaction for 2 or 3 years. So it's one of the values I think we bring to this market that we see market development and working with our clients over the long term is part of what we're supposed to be doing in this market.
Absolutely, and it's one of the elements of the market that's often not so visible to people because by the time we hear about a cat bond, it's usually when it's out in the market and with investors, and there's been months and months of work, sometimes years in advance of that. Are you seeing other Asian sovereigns looking at the potential for risk transfer?
Yes, there is a lot of interest. There are things going on. We're working on something called the CDRIF Initiative, Southeast Asian Disaster Risk Insurance Facility, which is in connection with governments of Singapore and Japan. That's at this stage, lesser developed Southeast Asian countries. So we're talking about relatively small amounts of insurance, some of it concessional, some of it market-based, but we expect that over time will grow in terms of the size of insurance of those countries and also other members joining and looking to use that facility. Certainly, there's no shortage of risk in Asia. I think there is a shortage of conventional capacity for all the risks that exist. So we definitely think of Asia as a growth area for us, so much so that we're in the World Bank Treasury considering establishing a presence in Singapore to try to help push some of these transactions along.
Very interesting. I think the work that your organization and others like you do to promote risk transfer as a whole is one of the main drivers for closing of the protection gap in some regions of the world, certainly today. Simon, let's move to you. You've worked on all of the recent catastrophe bonds to come out of Singapore, I believe, and the emergence of Singapore as a new domicile now means regional cedents could issue locally if they wanted to. Are you seeing interest from risk bearers in Asia? And I guess also, are you seeing sort of interest more generally from potential sponsors to come to Singapore as well?
Definitely, Steve. But as also what Michael mentioned, it takes time. And it's really an education process. So even getting the... I think really in Asia, you have a cultural difference, I would say. In certain markets where people may be more conservative, prefer the try and test it route. So really for us, as a new domicile, it's really convincing these potential sponsors in Asia to consider something new, maybe untested. I wouldn't really want to call it that, but I think it's definitely a new experience. So I would say, for example, the Japanese market, just getting the Japanese segment of the ILS market to look beyond the traditional domiciles and look towards Singapore as an option, I think it takes a certain bit of risk for them, and also takes time. So that's the part I think is most challenging, and you need to actually make the effort, especially in Asia, to have that face-to-face interaction with the potential risk bearers, sponsors. And we've seen the result of that effort with, of course, the NSI-sponsored Akibari. We So, and we see now that that has been happened. We have that Asian sponsored cat bond issued 1st April this year, that others will come forward, because that's the sentiment I got when we went around promoting Singapore, that basically nobody wanted to be the first. I think that was challenging, and to actually have that sort of confidence extended because of that, I would say, Asian element of face-to-face contact is actually quite important. So we've seen that with Akibari. And with that, I think of late also we've seen further interest from regional students, from the Korean markets, even, I would say, closer to home, towards Singapore. Interest that we will not have seen maybe last year, for example, but definitely this year we've seen an uptick. So hopefully with the successful issuances we've seen this year, more will come forward. And also, I guess, on the investor part, for the asset managers, it's also an education process for them to get more Asian investors interested in this particular asset class.
Indeed, yes, which there's interesting potential there as well on the investor side. And obviously, Singapore has a sort of fully functioning capital market that can take advantage of that as well, and a number of major investors who are already allocating to the space. Do you feel the Singapore marketplace is ready for expansion now? We heard Benny Che from the Monetary Authority this morning saying that the ambition is to expand the range of structures as well that are on offer there. Do you feel that's an important step?
It is. I think it's a critical step in the development of Singapore as a domicile. But I think the first step now, as what Benny explained, is to extend the grant. The next stage is probably Eileen can weigh in on this, is to then develop IRS instruments, sidecars, collateralized REIT, and that's really the next item on the agenda. Because one of the issues we face really is when interested risk bearers come to us, and many come asking about sidecar structure, it doesn't really sit well with the regulatory framework that we have now, because it's really geared towards cat bonds. So the next evolution really is to expand into those other areas where we've seen quite a lot of interest. And I'm sure yes. You would have also come across quite a number of queries on that front.
Absolutely. Ilian, do you have anything to add on that front?
Certainly. I think as part of our next phase of growth, I think we certainly want to, you know, diversify the use cases, ILS use cases that Singapore can support. But to do that in terms of supporting, you know, a diverse range of instruments, including, you know, collateralized REITs, sidecars, ILWs, and also different types of risks, right? Beyond that, CAT, we are talking now about man-made risks such as cyber, pandemic, you know, terrorism, operational risk, and the securitization and transfer to the capital markets. What do we need to do in terms of the underlying infrastructure, you know, and frameworks that we need to put in place? I think Simon touched on one aspect, which is the regulatory framework. But equally, we are looking at the corporate and legal structures as well, including whether or not Singapore should be putting in place a protected cell company structure, which we have also mentioned previously, to support basically multiple issuances, right? Because it actually supports, you know, the efficient segregation of assets and liabilities in a very robust way. So legal structure is one aspect, regulatory structure is one aspect, and certainly the tax structure is one aspect, because currently our tax incentives is still more geared towards, you know, debt-based securities like cat bonds. But certain ILS, you know, are issued in equity form, say preferential shares. So quite clearly, we will also need to think through about whether or not there's merit to introduce a very bespoke ILS tax incentive to further grow the market. Yeah. So I think this is all part of the ILS 2.0 work that my team is doing.
Thank you, Ilyin. Very interesting. It's good to hear that there's further developments in the works. Corey, the ILS market is always looking for new sponsors, obviously. It's one of the things we always talk about is how many new sponsors have come through each quarter. And we're all familiar with quarters where it's just the regular repeat issues we've seen sometimes for 15 or 20 years. But what are your teams seeing at the moment and in terms of the Asia market? And do you feel that sort of the advent of the Singapore ILS domicile and now the emergence of Hong Kong looking to also support ILS transactions, is that helping to broaden the understanding? And do you hear from more sponsors or potential sponsors now?
Absolutely. And that's probably been over the last, I'd say, 12 to 18 months a growing discussion of the use of ILS. And I think having the jurisdictions of Singapore and then now as Hong Kong is developing theirs has been a very big catalyst in expanding the conversation to folks that may not have actually thought about using ILS in whatever form. I'm encouraged to hear about the regulatory and the tax changes that are being discussed because some of those clients very much want to be able to execute, not necessarily in cap on form, but to be able to do it in different formats, whether it's sidecars, et cetera. And so I definitely think that you'll see folks that have never been present in the ILS market in any fashion come to the market once some of these changes are enabled from them. And by virtue of the regulators focusing on becoming comfortable themselves with ILS, it is a signal to the market that ILS is an acceptable tool. And so that does change the nature of conversations. Again, insurance penetration and growing coverage needs are also a catalyst along with pricing. But I think all of these together are brewing where we could definitely see a number of opportunities come through. But they do take time. And so that's probably the biggest thing is you'll see these periods where there's inactivity in the sense of there's no new issuance published within that time period, but what's happening behind the scenes is all the support work and getting them to a place, and then all of a sudden you'll see probably three or four pop up that'll come through fairly rapidly.
Yeah, interesting. And Ilyin, that sort of leads me on to ask you, How does the Monetary Authority engage with cedents and risk bearers, and how are you working to educate people on ILS being a viable risk transfer option now in the Asia region?
Yeah, I think there are a few prerequisites that need to be in place to really create an Asian ILS market. The first is about, the underlying data to model and securitize Asian-originated risk, right? And Japan and Australia, they have the benefit of having, one of the most organized loss histories, loss data that supports securitization of such risk, but less so for the rest of Asia. And certainly, we do have other initiatives like the Natural Catastrophe Data Analytics Exchange, to basically put together the NatCat data backbone, if you like, to raise the overall data hygiene levels in the region. I think that's really the first step. Without robust data to model and securitize risk, right, and to translate that into transparent and robust benchmarks, performance and risk benchmarks for investors, I think that will be difficult. So that will really, to me, would be a fundamental building block. The second is really about, the presence of a viable ILS domicile in Asia. We talked about Singapore and also we talked about Hong Kong as the next potential ILS hub. And I think it's important to have a viable ILS hub in the region to support the efficient issuances of ILS such that they become, easier, simpler and more widely accepted over time. And the third is demand, right? Even if we solve the supply side in terms of having data, having robust models, having a credible domicile, I think it will be for naught if there's no demand from global and Asian investors. And that's why roadshows by, you know, cedents and sponsors and partners like World Bank is very important to really up the awareness and comfort level of investors wanting to allocate into this asset class, which today is still, you know, seen as emerging, you know, esoteric asset class offering equity-like returns. But I think we need to really mainstream it and scale it up in a bigger way to attract a greater allocation over time. And lastly, is about the awareness, which all of you talked about, you know, awareness and education. Everyone in Asia knows how a traditional reinsurance contract works, but less so about a cat bond, which is still perceived to be administratively complex, right, and costly and difficult to understand. So I think we need to sort of demystify and simplify the role and benefits of ILS, and I think we need to do this together as a market.
Yes, I'd be all for that. our work at Artemis has been to try and demystify what is a very complex space for now 21 years. It's great that we're seeing the global expansion and interest now. The Monetary Authority also works in other areas promoting disaster risk financing and insurance more broadly. Are there any current initiatives focused on the protection gap?
Yes, Steve. I think earlier I mentioned the Natural Catastrophe Data Analytics Exchange. But just to sort of take one step backwards, I think we adopt a public-private partnership to boost disaster resilience in Asia. And that usually involves, you know, not just government regulators like ourselves, but also industry and academia to, you know, work across the entire value chain to actively identify, reduce and mitigate the risk exposures in Asia. And the fundamental building blocks, I would just sort of set out four key ones. The first is around risk assessment. How do we measure and quantify the economic and financial impact of disaster risk and factor this risk in our overall risk management strategies? Second would be around capacity building, right, to raise the level of awareness, institutional capacity, and regulatory and legal frameworks in countries to support the deployment of risk financing solutions. The third is around risk advisory. How do we actually go down to individual countries, insurers, corporates to develop bespoke and tailored solutions, right, and implement the most optimal risk financing strategy in response to the level of exposures and protection that they require? And lastly, I think as a leading, you know, risk financing hub, we do want to be a part of, you know, the solution to innovate and expand the suite of risk financing solutions that we can support, you know, ranging from sovereign risk pools like Seadrift to reinsurance to cat bonds, such that, you know, the countries and corporates and insurers can combine different instruments to address different layers of risk and financing needs and achieve, you know, the most optimal risk financing strategy. And I think in Singapore, we are really connecting the dots across the ecosystem. And I would just like to highlight three key regional initiatives that we are involved in. The first is NetCat DEX, which I highlighted earlier. We all know that, you know, in Asia, we suffer from a data and modeling challenge, right? There's a general lack of accurate and reliable loss data. And if available at all, they are usually, you know, poor quality and has poor resolution, which results in a significant deviation between, you know, the model output across even modeling firms and also across insurers. And you have seen how this played out in the case of the Thai floods, where it is a modeling blind spot. You know, in the past, nobody modeled it, and nobody actually took into account the secondary knock-on effects on the supply chains, right? So enter NetCat DEX, which is the Natural Catastrophe Data Analytics Exchange, led by the NTU, the Nanyang Technological University of Singapore, Institute of Cat Risk Management, together with industry. So it aims to be a high-resolution and geocoded data analytics exchange, which basically aggregate and fuse data from three different sources, right? One is basically top-down economic exposure and loss data that is really gathered from economic and population census data. The second source is really from satellite imagery and remote sensing technologies to capture the exposure data of buildings, right? For example, we can actually know the replacement value of the building and their contents, based on, the height, the construction type, the construction use, is it industrial, is it commercial, just from the, satellite data. And the third source is really from the bottom-up industry, basically the insurance exposure and loss data that we aggregate from primary insurers in the region. So with this high quality database, we basically hope to support more robust pricing and selection of risk, as well as, more importantly, catalyze innovative solutions, including modeled loss and industry loss warranties that is absolutely critical in the ILS space. Very quickly, let me just move on to the other two initiatives. I'm mindful of time. The second one is really what we call the ASEAN Disaster Risk Financing and Insurance Program, or ADRIFI for short. Essentially, it deals with the upstream components that I mentioned earlier, including risk assessment, capacity building, and risk advisory, right? And it is basically going to be led by a dual program office, led by the ASEAN Secretariat as well as the NTU ICRM to support that coordinating effort in ASEAN. And lastly, the third initiative is SeaDrift, which Michael also talked about. SeaDrift is a downstream solution. It is the first regional catastrophe risk facility in Asia. And it was incorporated and domiciled in Singapore as a trust owning a general insurer in 2019. And it is in the process of, offering its first product, which is a flood risk pool, covering the flood risks of Laos and Myanmar. And the plan is really to use, SeaDrift as a rallying point, a convening platform to launch other products, right? Covering different perils and other ASEAN countries. And we are, already looking at the feasibility of launching a second product involving public asset protection. And as Michael mentioned, there's certainly, I think, potential for SeaDrift to serve as a platform for regional cat bonds in future. Similarly to the Pacific Alliance deal involving Chile, Colombia, Mexico, and Peru, coming together to cover earthquake risk, which World Bank advised as well. Yeah, that's it for me.
Thank you, Ilyen. Thank you. So yes, you mentioned a number of things there that lead me on to sort of the next area I wanted to explore. You discussed the need for data and the lack of data sometimes, which is really key in areas where there's gaps in insurance penetration and protection. And one of the areas where we still see significant exposure that just hasn't been addressed in many cases is the corporate world as well. And obviously there's actually a history in Asia of corporate cat bonds going right the way back to, I think, about 97 or 98 with the Tokyo Disneyland Concentric transaction, a personal favorite of mine, and one of the first deals I really got to look at very closely. Do we feel that this, and I guess I'm aiming this at Corey or Michael, do we feel that this is an area of expansion, and how can we get more corporate sponsors to come to market? And is it a need for better data tools to allow them to actually measure their own exposure and realize where they're underinsured? Shall I throw that to Corey first?
Okay, happy to jump in. I think the one thing that's also very interesting to think about when corporates buy protection is that they buy for different reasons than insurers or reinsurers buy. They tend to be more earnings focused and the impact to their financials and signaling to their security holders And so therefore, they're not always looking for surplus replenishment in the way that an insurer or a reinsurer would be looking at the coverages. So we find the reasons that they want to buy are to, you know, in some cases you'd say, why aren't they buying for the more severe events in the coverage that they're looking for? And it's mainly because their traditional security holders tend to give them a pass when you have extraordinary events, because they understand that they're one-off situations, as opposed to are there more mid-level type of insurance events that affect the earnings of the operation. And so absent very significant events, COVID-19 is an example of that, of a significant event that I would put to the side, they tend to be buying more mid-level covers, in the sense of it's not the covers that respond to the most severe events, but to the ones that occur a little bit more frequently. Tokyo Disneyland was a great transaction. We'd love to see something like that come back to the market, but was done for a very specific reason, in the sense that, as I understand, there was financing associated that the organization had taken out. And what they were concerned about was the business interruption effect of to be able to service and repay that debt if there was an earthquake during that time period that would affect people coming to the site. They actually weren't concerned from a property damage perspective to their infrastructure, but more about, is there a cash flow interruption that then feeds into stress of being able to repay the financing? So I think business interruption covers, using this type of solution for helping to solve business interruption scenarios, I think is exactly what this market could be helpful for. And it's not limited to the Nat Cat risk. I think COVID-19 is another example. There's a number of sectors where you can look at generally cash cows, and their margins, you know, are dependent on kind of the turnover that they're doing in their specific sector. COVID-19 has turned that on its head, where you have no turnover, so therefore you have no margin. There were a number of scenarios where people were talking about business interruption related covers into COVID, and I think that's only going to accelerate once we come out. I think the last piece is that this market has been more focused on nat cat risks and not as much on man-made risks, some of the man-made risks away from like the COVID scenario, but you know, whether it be explosions or things of that nature. And so that necessarily limits what type of entity may be actually looking at this market versus the other opportunities in competitive risk transfer markets.
Yes, it's very interesting how you described the business interruption application of the concentric cat bond, because obviously that is a similar type of coverage that many large corporations would be looking for in the case of a pandemic or other major supply chain related issue. At this time, and it does seem that the cat bond and parametric triggers could be a reasonable solution with available capacity for those. What needs to happen to stimulate corporations and other risk holders to look to risk transfer for those? Because often those risks are barely covered by their traditional insurance.
Yeah. Again, I think it's I don't mean to keep repeating about COVID, but this highlights that type of scenario. All of a sudden, that you're not getting the revenue that you used to have because people are either trafficking through or what they're doing. And I do think that risk managers are going to start to focus on not just COVID-19 or pandemic situations, but broader situations where that can have a business interruption or a continued business interruption to their business. We have been doing a series within the Marsh McLennan companies with particularly with our Marsh colleagues in that business unit in educating them on the availability of ILS solutions and how it can work in concert with other protection forms that they're using. So we're definitely doing our work to make sure that people on the front lines talking with constituents that may be starting to need this type of protection are armed with enough information to be able to speak about it intelligently. So I think that, March McLennan, we're here and available and love to have conversations with specific students about problems that they're looking to solve. We get the wide gamut of how this could apply. And again, our market is still, it's not young, but it's still youthful and is still, learning how to take on, the collection of perils that are out there. And that's why this is complementary to whatever you're doing on the insurance or the reinsurance side, depending on how you're accessing the market.
Thank you, Corey. Michael, what's your view on sort of unlocking some of the risk that sits in entities around the world, in Asia and other areas as well? And do you feel, Corey raised an interesting point really around COVID-19, that obviously it has heightened the perception that entities have of risk, perhaps. Are you beginning to see that in your work, that people are now more open to risk transfer in general, or becoming more intrigued as to what's possible?
Yeah, it may be too early to tell. I mean, we definitely have seen people say that the COVID experience makes them just realize in general the economic impact of sudden shocks and the need to do ex ante risk management to look at potential sudden shocks, which also can be other sorts of natural catastrophes. And we saw that, for instance, Steve, I think it was actually part of an interview that you did, but we also got directly from the Jamaican Minister of Finance, who was talking about their plans. And we had been working with Jamaica, looking at the market, and there was a lot of sense when COVID, and then, well, of course, countries like Jamaica won't be interested in, won't be worried about typhoons and earthquakes right now because they have this huge COVID-related risk. It actually highlighted for them the need to have this kind of protection, like the potential economic impact of a double shock of going through COVID and then also being hit by a major hurricane was so extreme, such extreme potential negative for the economy, that it actually made them more interested. So certainly that would be the our expectation, is that people will become even more eager to management transactions in the future, now that they've seen what event like COVID.
Thank you, Michael. So we've actually got a few questions in from the audience now, so I think maybe we'll turn to some of those for a few minutes as we're coming up to sort of 10 minutes from time. First one we have is related to parametric coverage, and how important could that be going forwards, and I guess specifically around the development of technology solutions, and obviously sensing and satellites are becoming more and more accurate all the time. Do we see parametric triggers playing a significant role? And are they also, and this is combining with another person's question, are parametric triggers also a partial answer to the lack of adequate data and modeling capabilities in some regions? Who would like to answer that?
I can start off, and then certainly welcome my other colleagues to jump in. Absolutely. I think the use of pandemic covers is a great way for buying protection and not having to worry about the justification of the source of the loss. Many people, I think, take a false comfort in looking at their insurance policy and saying I'm 100% covered for the kind of coverage that I'm looking for, when in fact, when you start to dive into the complexity of some of the coverages, what you start to find is that there are sublimits within the policies, that all of a sudden your policy begins to look more like Swiss cheese. And so the nice thing about a parametric cover is, assuming you're comfortable with the basis risk, which means, does it respond when I want it to respond? And you obviously want that to be as close to 100% alignment. But if it doesn't respond, is it okay that it didn't respond? Because if you wanted it to respond and it didn't respond, that's the negative basis risk that we worry about, as opposed to you get an over-response And so you have to balance in that structuring design. And that's probably the biggest barrier to moving the parametric board is having that basis risk. But the nice thing about it is you don't have any justification of where the source of loss is coming from. You have a pot of capital, whether it's in insurance, reinsurance, or derivative form, that can step up in the situation. I think also, depending on the design of the structure, it eliminates certain aspects of the models that may cause investor concern. So for instance, if we're talking about the vulnerability of an exposure, and we're uncomfortable with that aspect of the model, but we are comfortable with the hazard component, which talks about the frequency of the events, well, then we're really focusing on the hazard piece of it in the parametric structure and removing away elements of the vulnerability that may cause execution concerns. Certainly, I think the biggest thing is we've always said that the modeling help guides us forward because it gives us that currency discussion of how do we price risk, because it gives us a baseline of what that risk metric should be. But vintage of model and how well it's modeled all plays into how investors are willing to risk their capital to take on these risks. But I definitely think parametrics are going to continue to be a way forward, and I think can offer a lot of solutions and kind of holistic business solutions without having to justify the source of the loss.
Sure. Thank you, Corey. Michael, I guess back to you at the World Bank. Parametric triggers are part of your toolkit. You use them widely in transactions as they suit sovereigns. Do you see these as critical, and do you think we're going to see increasingly sort of well-calibrated triggers as technology advances?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, for us, parametric triggers are essential for a lot of our transactions because they're all about speed of payment. A lot of the transactions we do, the governments are looking at this as a source of immediate liquidity or almost immediate liquidity after an event. So an indemnity transaction doesn't provide that kind of support because, of course, when you're talking about a government insuring against a major event, the ultimate reconstruction costs are going to be beyond the capacity of a single transaction to provide enough funds. So really what they're looking at is not reconstruction, but emergency losses, immediate liquidity. So parametric's been essential. And in fact, not just parametric, but as quick determining parametric as possible. The first time we did a transaction where there was a potential trigger was a Mexico cat bond for a hurricane event where we were using data that took 3 to 4 months to stabilize. And we thought when we put the transaction in place, that sounds reasonable enough. And Mexico was comfortable waiting 3 or 4 months because they wanted to make sure they were using the best possible data. Then the event happened, and I was asked every day by my management whether it triggered for 4 months. And on the Mexico side, they were getting the same thing. So we discovered that there is just no political acceptability post a major event that obviously gets attention in the country to say, we'll tell you if your coverage is triggered in 6 months from now. It just doesn't work. And we saw maybe similar impact, slightly different issue, but similar with our pandemic transaction, where there was a set of triggers that took time to develop. In fact, one of the triggers was, in fact, a period of time had to elapse while the event was still growing. And there was absolutely, at the political level, no patience to wait. So definitely parametric and quick triggering parametric are key. It does keep you awake at night, the basis risk issues that Corey was mentioning. Because that's also a huge political risk. I mean, waiting is a political risk, but also waiting or determining immediately and finding out that big event didn't trigger is also a huge political risk. So the more optimization tools that the market can develop so that people can get to refine their parameters as much as possible, I think are key. And finally, I would just say that I think the other thing we find with our parametric transactions is investors like them because investors have been made to wait themselves for so long to get some of their money back or to find out what the ultimate reckoning on a bond has been. that we find that there's actually really a high level of demand. So it benefits both our cedents and the investors when we can do a parametric.
Thank you, Michael. Simon, I'll call on you for this question. Do you feel that the ILS framework in Singapore and now the emergence of a marketplace there is helping to educate investors in the region? And are you having conversations with increasing numbers of investors around the transactions and what can now be done?
Definitely. I think the first few cases definitely showcase that Singapore is a viable domicile. And it's really the proof of concept that was demonstrated with the early deals. So we've had conversations with different stakeholders, cedents, asset managers. So it's really generated a lot of interest to answer your question, not just locally in Singapore, but across the region. So I think doors have been opened. I had gone out maybe 3-4 years back, I think the doors will be shut in my face. But now I think people are quite ready to sit down to have a conversation. And really, I think it goes back to the point about what Singapore is offering in terms of the entire ecosystem, the ILS platform, SeaDrift. And I think what we are trying to be is really a marketplace for, I think, effective risk transfer. And like I said, the conversations have been, I think, quite encouraging. But we do see a lot more interest, and it's the education process right now that the part where you are planting the seeds, I think, and it'll take time for, I think, the fruits to be, I think, harvested. And that'll take, as for Michael and Corey, the time, which is the journey we're on at the moment.
Yes, it's obviously it's one of the key things in the ILS market is the time taken to structure and put together these deals is significant and needs to be because of the investor side of the transaction as well. Do you feel there's an opportunity to grow the ILS market with using Asian investor capital as well over time?
Definitely, but I think, like I said earlier, it's just getting people comfortable with this idea. It's still quite new to a number. I think it was quite clear from last year's conference after doing the tea breaks and conversation I had last year. If we had a conference in Singapore this year, I suspect I'll see the same crowd of people asking the same questions. And really, it's I think there's a hunger to learn more about this. And I think the investors, the fund managers out there really also, I think, have lots to learn. And I hope, and I think I see for everybody here, that we hope and we're quite confident as well that the market will grow in time to come.
Yeah, I would add what I think from an investor perspective, I think this is a great opportunity to be looking in the market. One, we're seeing that rates are increased because of the collective losses over the last 2 years, but then also the COVID impact. So you're coming in at a time where you're getting better compensated in general, not for every region, but you're getting compensated better for the risk that you could have taken relative to last year. I think that the roadshows and the sponsoring that the World Bank did through the Philippines Cap Fund and the dialogue that's happening through conferences like this are extremely important. In-source money thinks they know how to, lose money on credit structures by the fact that they feel like, there's going to be a workout process and I won't lose 100 cents on the dollar. And the insurance-linked notes and the fact that, it would take a parametric structure overnight, it could be 100% loss. You go to bed, there was an earthquake overnight, and you wake up and it could be 100% loss, certainly can be disconcerting. And then if there is no workout mechanism except for waiting for the parameters to become available to let you know whether it's 100% or something less than that, related loss. And so there is an appetite in the education process that an investor has to go through in looking at this asset class. But I think when you look at the benefits of the liquidity that the space has shown, at least through the cap on market, the return profile that you can see between the sidecar, collateralized REIT, and cap on market, and the low correlation, at least when you're focusing on nat cat risk and certain other types of risk, relative to what's happened in the broader capital markets, this should be very attractive to in-source money. I would expect, and it may not happen immediately, it may be 3 months, it may be 6 months, it may be a year down the road, but having COVID-19 is another data point for an investor to say, how did this space perform? Just like when we went back to the 08 financial crisis and how it performed. And I think they're going to be very pleasantly surprised. I mean, you just look at the Swiss Re Cap Bond Index was at and down between end of January to the beginning of April was down only minus 0.8%. And historically, it's been flat to actually negative during the first quarter. But yet, when you look at the S&P 500 as an example, it was down 22% in that same time period. So when you are talking about the impact of a broader capital markets event relative to the performance of this space, it again reaffirms that this is a lower correlation effect and should have value. And the fact that there was liquidity in the market, we saw well probably $1.5 billion, maybe up to $2 billion of bonds trade between mid-March to, I would say, beginning of June, that folks were able to find liquidity at pricing. That was I think again, if the in-source money that's been looking and learning about this space continues to do that in evaluating over the last 3 months, they're going to find that this may be an attractive segment to go into their investments.
Thanks, Corey. That's a great summing up. So we're actually just run over time, but I'm going to ask each of you just for a final thought on the future role of ILS in closing Asia's risk financing gaps. Ilian, what do you think the role of ILS is in the future? Is it larger, smaller? Are we going to see this segment play an increasing role in preventing or financing disaster risk?
Definitely. I think the ILS market has already grown to become a meaningful share of total reinsurance capital and will continue to, you know, grow in strength as we continue to find ways to securitize and transfer different kinds of risk, including man-made ones, to the capital markets. And as we go on this journey, I think Singapore is committed to create an Asian ILS market, connecting Asian capital to Asian risk via, you know, Singapore as an Asian ILS domicile. And we are certainly, you know, hope to work very closely with industry and welcome your feedback and suggestions on how we can do better. Thank you.
Thank you, Ilian. And Michael, final thought from you?
I think for us, in terms of sponsors, certainly I would look in the medium term for Asia to be our biggest source of transactions, just because of the amount of risk and the interest we're seeing. So a real question in my mind is how much of those transactions will be bought by Asian investors? And I think that trend will also pick up, but it's starting at a low base right now. But definitely in terms of sponsors, Asia is going to be a major priority for us. And again, as I said, that's one of the reasons we're actually even looking to establish a presence, because we see the potential.
Great. Thank you, Michael. Simon, final thought from you?
I just want to say that given the journey we've been on the last 18 months, 2 years, what's very clear to me is really the resolve. I think at least for the MAS, trying to build and contribute to the effective disaster risk financing platform in Singapore as a base. And also that ability, I think, to adapt to something that is quite new and also to make it work. I think that's where, I guess, the success that we've seen has really been one of the factors, the ability for us to, I think, learn and also adapt. And also, I think, in the future, contribute further the needs of the region.
Great. Thank you, Simon. And Corey, last word from you.
Sure. So I would say that, I have been encouraged by the, you know, having been in this space for more than 20 years, the level of dialogue over the last 3 to 4 years has been remarkable, and it grows every year. I know the interest that's pent up once we get through regulatory and potential tax changes. Do we get into the right kind of pricing environment? I think there's a lot more opportunity there. And encouraging by that is that, you know, Singapore SBRVs, there was one in 2018, there was three in 2019, and they've had four in the first half of this year execution, and we look forward to seeing this in the second half. And, you know, we're on the MMC side very proud to support the Asia region. We've done 7 out of those 9, or been involved in 7 of those 9 transactions. We want to see more go out of there, but I also want to see that the solutions that we can provide are meaningful to the Asia-Pac region. And so I think that there's a lot of help that can be provided through these solutions. And I think I would really love to see growth in the investors that are participating coming out of the Asia-Pac region. I think we see it from certain sectors and it flows through certain ILS funds, but we'd see love to see a lot more growth, because I think there's a lot of untapped potential there from a capital perspective.
Great. Thank you, Corey. So that's a fantastic way to sum up. I'd just like to thank all 4 of the speakers today. They've done a great job. I really appreciate you being part of this. And thank you to everybody who tuned in to watch. You'll all be able to watch anything you missed on demand. And we'll be back tomorrow with 2 further sessions, the first of which is about parametric risk transfer. And then we have a keynote from Aon Securities' Paul Schultz later in the day as well. So hope to see you all tomorrow. Thank you again to my speakers, and thank you for watching.
Thank you.